This morning is House Bill 3298. I'm going to open a public hearing on that bill. Ellen, if you'd please give us a brief synopsis.
Yes, thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. House Bill 3298 authorizes the Department of Economic and Community Development to approve the designation of up to 10 additional enterprise zones, urban or non-urban.
And we have with us this morning the bill's chief sponsor, Representative Bruin, and I suspect Ms. Bruin.
Many years, Ms.
Bruin. Would you like to come up and sit in the chair, too?
Yeah.
We'd love to have you up here.
No.
A born leader.
Take charge.
Welcome and good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I'm Representative Scott Bruin. I represent House District 37, which is primarily Tualatin and West Lynn. And this is my top political advisor and communications director, Natalie Bruin. Can you say good morning?
Good morning.
Good morning, Natalie.
Chair and Committee, thank you for hearing this bill this morning. This is actually a very, very simple bill and identical to one that we actually did last session. I served on what was the equivalent of this committee last session. We heard this, and what it does is simply, as it was described, adds 10 enterprise zones to the current pool. The current pool as it sits right now, I'll probably be wrong by a number. There's 30 that were pre-established by the governor's office, and there's 27, including the 10 additional that we did last year. We had 47. We went to 57 last year. This bill would take the number, and correct me if I'm wrong, take it from 57 to 67 enterprise zones. Not to belabor, you know, the origin of enterprise zones, but I did a little research on this last session. Basically, the concept of what our current understanding of enterprise zone is sort of came out of Great Britain, actually, in the late 70s and the early 80s when they were having tremendous economic difficulties. And this is one of the tools that they used, they developed and used for their economic regeneration, if you will, and it sort of migrated itself to America, was used specifically and effectively in inner city areas to sort of help with economic problems in inner cities. And, of course, most, if not all, states have adopted enterprise zones in one form or another. It's once again they're fairly simple in what they do. They allow a company, as long as it has as long as it's a designated enterprise zone by statute, and as long as the local governments agree, it allows a company to come in and have a period of tax abatement to help get their feet on the ground. In Oregon, I find this especially important as we continue to lose manufacturing jobs, but as we continue to want to trade, if you will, in the traded sector industries, these wealth-created industries that are mostly trade-oriented industries where we're selling not only to other states but to other countries. Usually those industries are capital-intensive, and this is what this serves. This primarily helps capital-intensive industries. Service industries or other industries that may not be so capital-intensive, this really doesn't matter that much. But for capital-intensive industries with lots of assets tied up into property, this is a real sort of boost in the pants. A couple of examples of where this has been particularly effective. In fact, this committee toured Hynix in Eugene in 2005. It's a semiconductor fab facility. It's been a great addition to the Eugene community. It's a Korean company, if I'm not mistaken, Representative Lim. As was sort of presented to this committee when we traveled down there 2 years ago, the reason they're here and the reason they're able to stay here are the state's enterprise zones. Another great example, which falls into Representative Dalem's district, is Google in the Dalles. And you know, at the time, it was, I remember 2 years ago, hey, we can't talk about this yet because, you know, there's still some things going on. But now we have the benefit of sort of the negotiations and discussions that were happening. As I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, Representative, but Google's two main interests in coming to Oregon and the Dalles specifically were, one, Oregon doesn't have a sales tax, and two, they had some real advantages with our enterprise zone structure. So,
very high on the list.
Very high on the list. Thank you. So basically, this is just that. This is taking a good concept. It's adding 10 more, which I think is a reasonable number. It's identical to the bill we did last year. Right now, we're enjoying sort of good economic times. Obviously, we see that in the budget when we see the strength in our revenues over the 2 year period. But I think there's a lot of things on the horizon, not the least of which is the housing market that creates some concern for a few of us. And so, you know, we start looking 2 years out and what the state might need. need to help foster so we don't go backwards in economic development, and enterprise zones, I think, are one of those tools. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Bruin. From the committee, Vice Chair Riley, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative. There are three of us, I believe, on the committee that served on the committee with you last session, and that was a very interesting and enlightening committee to be on.
It's a great committee.
I'm going to save most of my questions for the department, but just one. Do you know of any cities or any areas right now that want an enterprise zone and there's none available?
No, in fact, I think that's a great question, Representative and Mr. Chair. I think, if I'm not mistaken, and I'll be wrong by one or two, but I think there's three available as we speak. I think within our current designation, and the department, I'm sure, will correct me where I'm wrong, but as I understand it, we're two or three from filling our quota, if you will. Okay. Which is great. I you know, with this, but we don't know what happens over the next 2 years, and that's basically what this is about. We don't know what happens with demand. We certainly don't know what happens with the overall economic picture. So this is sort of suggesting that, hey, if hope to God this doesn't happen, but if we do have an economic downturn of any magnitude, is two or three available enough to sort of hit the goals we want to hit?
Especially since we filled 7 of the 10 that we created last time.
Right.
In 2 years.
In good economic times.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Bruin, oftentimes there is a criticism of enterprise zones that it, in essence, is a tax giveaway that sometimes we don't receive benefits on the backside from. I know in my own district recently, Enterprise Zone was in part responsible for the location of a paper machine that, had those tax benefits not been available, that machine would have gone to a neighboring state. The machine project itself is $250 million. When one factors in the secondary and tertiary impacts, conservatively, it's anticipated that that will pump roughly $750 million, and that is a conservative low-end figure, very significant in a rural economy. Could you comment on kind of the competing interests of, yes, it is attractive to companies, but there is considerable criticism that it...
Exactly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a great question, especially in light of the committee that both you and I sat on yesterday in our Revenue Committee, and for those on the rest of this committee, we heard 5 bills, or we had the initial public hearings on 5 or 6 bills, all of which seek to sort of get a better understanding and gauge the financial revenue impact of 300, if I'm not mistaken, 350, some odd number of tax credits and tax breaks that this state has, and all of which has their own constituency, and we all love a few of them, but when you aggregate them, it's a lot of money. There's no question about that. Enterprise zones, what we're looking at here, certainly fall into that overall pie, if you will. The criticism of the tax credits is that they don't necessarily do what the advocates and the legislature, when they pass them, whenever they may have passed them, don't do what they suggest they're going to do. I think that's a fair question to ask. It's a good reason to have sunsets on everything we look at, honestly, in my opinion. And I think that if you distill down the tax credits and look, I mean, everything from enterprise zones to everything, I mean, there's 300 and some odd of them. Sometimes it might be hard to sort of quantify the benefit to the state. And it's not always quantitative benefits we're looking for. Sometimes we're looking for social benefits as well. One that comes to mind that came in front of that committee was the adoption tax credit. The adoption tax credit costs the state of Oregon money. But is it good social policy? I would argue it absolutely is. So, I mean, you can't really do necessarily a cost-benefit analysis. With enterprise zones, you can, and you just have to look at the evidence of enterprise zones. Mr. Chair, you cited a great example of direct investment and direct economic activity and, of course, direct jobs that will come because of an enterprise zone. We looked at, once again, this committee looked at Hynix very, very thoroughly 2 years ago. Absolutely. I mean, the school system in Eugene, we got a little bit of a comparison of what would happen to the school district in Eugene with or without Hynix in their community, and it's a big chasm that would have to be filled without Hynix. And another example, I'm just hitting the big ones because these are the ones that have big public names everybody's heard. And I think that you know, obviously they haven't fully drawn out their investment yet, but the investment from Google and the Dalles and the jobs that creates and the sort of jobs, the industries, the jobs of tomorrow, not necessarily the jobs of yesterday, which we all sort of like, but those jobs of tomorrow that we know are our future, high tech, biotech, life sciences, nanosciences, all down the road. Enterprise zones, because of the way it treats capital-intensive industries, is of utmost benefit, with lots of good examples of the jobs created. So that's a long-winded answer, but of course I'm a politician.
Thank you very much, Representative Dahlem.
Yes, when we talk about those examples and others, and from our previous discussion, there were some sideboards on this legislation last time in that it was originally designed, I believe, to stimulate economic activity in depressed areas of the state. Does this bill take that into account, and is that still a consideration?
It is. There's some of us who would suggest that, you know, that are free market purists that would suggest maybe we should turn the whole state into an enterprise zone. I realize there's more opposition to that than there is favor of that. There it's all in statute what the economic sideboards are that a zone has to qualify. The economic criteria that have to be applicable for a zone designation to be even entertained, and those are all in statute, those are all in current statute, and this bill doesn't change that at all. So all the existing sideboards, and I've got the statute here, but the specifics are better left for the department. But all of the economic sideboards that are in place will not be changed by this bill at all. The 10 that we would be adding with this bill would still have to adhere to the existing economic criteria.
Then, how many of the 57 zones now have attracted an industry? Do you have a count?
I don't have a count, I'm sorry.
I'll save that one for later.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Bruin, is there any method to the madness for
10?
For 10?
Yes. Whether it's scientific or not, that's a different discussion. This bill or the similar bill came up last session, and when it came up last session, it was a much broader bill. In fact, it started statewide, and we got it down to. And I have to maybe a couple of the people who were on the board or on the committee last year, Representative Lim, remember. I think maybe it was 30. I could be. I'm sure I'm wrong. I have a horrible head for remembering this sort of things. But it went statewide. Then it went, I think, to 30. I may be wrong on that. And then after a lot of deliberation in the equivalent of this committee, 10. And so that's the method to the madness, if you will. It's like, okay, had a lot of deliberation. We got to 10. It's 2 years later. We've used 70% of those 10. We've got 2 years to go. Does it make sense to add 10 more?
Very good. Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bruin, thanks for coming and giving us this bill to look at. Sometimes I look at these things, and being that Hynix is in my particular district, I'm pretty familiar with that. And, you know, it paints a pretty rosy picture for jobs and those sorts of things. But there's also some pain that comes with that, and it hasn't always been for many in the Eugene area where we see a lot of lost revenue, I suppose. And you could argue that if Hynix wasn't there, you know, we would do that. But they're really, you know, I don't know if Hynix would tell you that the reason they moved there was because of the enterprise zone. Certainly, you know, it's an enticement for them. I wouldn't dispute that. But their major reasons for being there were water and the availability of a skilled workforce, for example, and its proximity to the University of Oregon and, you know, some other nice things about the community. And there is a substantial amount of, I guess, public funds that are being used on these enterprise zones, whether it's direct funds or indirect funds that we could have had into our system, and that has caused some amount of shortfalls for other parts of our local government. And so I do worry about, you know, just assuming that enterprise zones are the thing that attracts business to Oregon, and we should do that increasingly, that every business that wants to come to Oregon, we're gonna help subsidize every business with an enterprise zone and other tax benefits. And oftentimes I see, and you being in the construction industry, one thing that I've seen with economic development funds and enterprise zones is we see a lot of those construction jobs being outsourced to companies from out of state who come in with cheap labor forces and undermine our community.
I'm absolutely opposed to that as a Portland contractor.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Director Repine's here, and I've had that discussion with him as well, you know, because I've seen it happen with Lowe's and in Lebanon. I've seen it happen in Eugene. I've seen it happen in many places around the state where we're using public funds, basically, whether it's direct or indirect, and sometimes you question, you know, whether we really need to use that much in public dollars to entice these businesses, and just an ever-increasing subsidy of industry when, you know, it really kind of brings into question, do we really need to do that much of it?
Right.
So, you know, I'm not disputing that we have certain areas where enterprise zones have been effective, but, you know, to continually expand them and to revenue to the cities and the counties where when they are really strapped for those revenues sometimes. We do that at the state level, and granted the locals can make a choice of whether they want to go that direction or not, but I enter that water very slowly.
No, I appreciate it. Can I
please?
No, I Representative, I think your concerns are absolutely valid and part of this discussion, and they're very similar to the discussions that we had 2 years ago on this committee as well. I hope I didn't. I don't want to overstate enterprise zones. I don't look at them as any sort of panacea to, you know, to economic nirvana at all. I look at them as a tool, and as you well said, Representative, especially in your example at Hynix and Eugene, if I implied that, I didn't mean to imply that. That's the sole reason they're there. Of course, they're there because of a great. I mean, I lived in Eugene for 4 years. So I love Eugene. It's a great place to live. Great resources. You mentioned the water. Wonderful town. Wonderful university town. A high qualified workforce. But you know, the fact of the matter is, we live in a nation that has a lot of those same qualities. You know, you can find those qualities in Washington. Sometimes you can even find them in California, although it's pretty rare. I'll give you that. But so, you know, it's one of those things that sometimes we need as the extra push, if you will, to help Oregon and Oregon industries, once again, especially in the highly capital intensive industries. There is a cost. There's no question that there is a cost to an enterprise zone. There's also usually no question that there's a benefit as well. We lose property tax, you know, asset taxes, if you will, for the example in Eugene. We also gain how many jobs paying above average wages, far above average wages, if I'm not mistaken. They're all paying, you know, state income taxes as well as every other tax that goes along with those individuals. So, you know, what do we gain and what do we lose? And I understand the difference in that the state is really benefiting from a lot of those income taxes, where the counties and the cities perhaps are losing because of the property tax abatement. A couple points to that, though, they are temporary. Okay, they're not. It's not a permanent tax abatement. It's designed to get people in the door, if you will, and to help them with those startups. When the investment in the capital expenditures is the highest. I would also say that, and it's also in statute. I'm sure you'll have testimony later that'll suggest that it is, you know, the local taxing districts, the special service districts, you know, they're a little bit afraid of this because they don't know what it means, and so they want the ability to opt out. And I think that's an absolute fair discussion to have. I mean, nobody's certainly not my intent, is to ram an enterprise zone down a community, down the throat of a community who doesn't want an enterprise zone, or where the majority of the people within a given community do not want an enterprise zone for whatever the reason may be. There are reasons to have them, and there's reasons to not have them. This merely, what we're doing here merely gives communities the opportunity to have that discussion. Whereas if it's capped, and especially if we hit an economic downturn, communities don't have the opportunity to have that discussion to weigh out the pros and the cons.
Additional questions or comments for Representative Bruner or Natalie?
Any closing comments you'd like to make? Okay.
So, Natalie, this is your dad's bill that we just talked about. So this is the pressure. Is this a good bill? Yes. Yes is a good answer.
My political advisor is very cautious about the words of the bill.
She's been listening to me.
Is it a great bill?
It's your dad's bill. It's a great
bill. Or
great bill.
Great. Should pass. Thank you very, very much. Natalie, we'll see you later, maybe on the House floor today.
Yeah.
Thank you for coming.
Okay.
Next, I'd like to call up Senator Walker and Hasina Squires, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I could hardly contain myself in the back of the room, and I hate to say something negative about the good representative's bill, especially since his political advisor is in the room, but e-zones make my e-zones make my skin crawl. I'm sorry. I just shudder, and I testified about a week or so ago over in the Senate that if I could obliterate them from the statute, I would. But we've become addicted to enterprise zones and tax breaks in this state, and I think we need a strong dose of methadone to take ourselves out of that addiction. And I mean that in all seriousness. I could barely contain myself because the good representative brought up Hynix. Oh my, we could talk about Hynix. And he also mentioned that the E-zones are not permanent. Well, I'll have to share with you that Hynix is still in an E-zone. They've been in an E-zone ever since they've been in Eugene, and they just keep re-upping the enterprise zone. It took the change of mayors to finally get some accountability in that enterprise zone. Hynix sucked at the well of our county tax break system. We finally got a new mayor. They negotiated some terms where Hynix had to put some money back into the school district because they were taking money out with their property tax break. And then the company wasn't happy enough with that. They turned around and sued the Department of Lane County Assessment and Taxation, and they won $2 million back saying that their property was overvalued. So if you want to talk about Hynix, it's probably not a good thing, a good conversation with me. But let me begin by saying also the good representative said there's been some discussion about turning the whole state into an E-zone. I actually thought about bringing you an amendment this morning. If legislative council was not so busy, I would have brought you one, surely in jest. But that's what we're doing. We're turning the whole state into one big enterprise zone. And quite frankly, it might be easier to do that. We could eliminate the department. I love the department head. I respect him, admire him, but I believe even when he was a legislator in this building, he recommended getting rid of the department. So the words come back to haunt us sometime. We are having a great discussion about enterprise zones over on the Senate side, just to let you know. Senate Bill 151 would extend the enterprise zones out to some gosh knows how long. I have the bill here, but I testified in opposition to that, and I also offered up some amendments. And there was an interesting amendment to that offered by Senator Larry George. If any of you were in the building, some of you, I don't think, maybe Representative Lim, when we had the baseball bill. Does anybody remember the baseball stadium? They were going to pay for that by sequestering the income and then paying the taxes out of the income. Well, Senator Larry George had a great idea for enterprise zones that we sequester the income and we share it back with the counties, because quite frankly, the counties lose in these sorts of things because we lose the property tax, but the state gets the income tax. So I thought it was a pretty novel idea. It didn't go very far, but it was worth the conversation. Ms. Squires is going to talk to you about a report that she has that the special districts did, and I would encourage you all to read it. I know that Jack Roberts from my community has weed all over it, but quite frankly, it is a good report. I would recommend for your reading another report, Rethinking Growth Strategies. This comes from Robert Lynch, and it's from the Economic Policy Institute, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization that seeks to broaden the public debate about strategies to achieve a prosperous and fair economy. It's a great book. I just want to read a couple of small points from it. The very first page on page 3 says, myths and exaggerations, when they are repeated often enough, may become etched in people's consciousness as facts. Great line, because that's what we fall into when we fall into this belief that property tax breaks and economic incentives help our businesses prosper. The perception that Oregon may not be business friendly if we don't offer all these juicy, wonderful tax breaks is also an error and a fallacy, because as this study has shown and this research report says, it is unlikely that business decision makers are apt to be persuaded by perceptions rather than by the facts of business costs and benefits. And I would quote to you Paul O'Neill. I love quoting Paul O'Neill, CEO, former CEO of Alcoa and U.S. Treasury Secretary, and he says, as a businessman, I never made an investment decision based on the tax code. If you are giving money away, I will take it. If you want to give me inducements for something, I am going to do anyway. I will take it. He said that in 2001 during his confirmation hearings. How simple, how eloquent, how right on as a businessman telling you, if you're going to stick something in my hand when I extend my hand out to you, I'll take it. But he didn't need it. His business didn't need it. Businesses don't make decisions based on the tax code. They make their decisions based on what Representative Holey was saying. Water. The abundance of water. Hynix needed a lot of water for what they do. They're a chip manufacturing plant. They needed the university. They needed the diversity of the community. They needed all of those things. They didn't need our little tax break. I would also tell you that if you're going to pass this bill, which I hope you don't, that there are only two requirements in the state enterprise zone statute. Two. Just two. And communities can expand upon those if they wish. Eugene and Ashland have done so. But simply two. You have to invest at least $50,000 in a building or major equipment within the zone, and you must increase your employment by at least 10%. Whoop-de-doo. It doesn't say that your employment has to be living wage jobs. It doesn't say that you have to provide health care to your employees. And it doesn't say that you must keep these people employed. So I would beseech you to also read another article called Boondoggle in the Eugene Weekly that was printed in May of 2003. Alan Pittman did this story, and let me just highlight a couple of things. When Sony came to Springfield in 1994, state and local governments lavished more than $12 million of tax breaks and subsidies to the corporation. Oregon couldn't be more proud or more excited than to welcome Sony, then Governor Barbara Roberts gushed. But 9 years later, Oregon isn't so proud. Now, this was in 2003. The high-tech industry in the state paid untold hundreds of millions of dollars to recruit is in the dumps. Sony, I might advise you, first laid off a number of workers. Then they hired them back, different workers, at a lower salary. And then, poof, Sony was gone after they exhausted the tax breaks. And, Mr. Chair, GP in your district that got an enterprise zone break? They laid off 100 workers. So it's a consistent issue. Eugene built a parking garage for Symantec. Symantec said they outgrew their facilities in Eugene, so they moved to Springfield. But I suggest to you that they moved to Springfield because they were chasing more tax breaks. It isn't what the program says it is. Am I against all tax breaks? Absolutely not. But there is no accountability. You ask the department what they make them accountable for. It's not really anything. So I would ask you today, I have a bill in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee that we're going to be hearing in 10 minutes. And I know you're in committee, but perhaps you can listen to it later. It's Senate Bill 518. And it puts all of these little corporate expenditures up on the Internet. And it requires accountability. How many jobs have you produced? What have you brought into the community? And a number of other things. And you know the sweetest provision about this one? And I stole this bill from Illinois, but there are several states doing this. And we actually brought out the former senator from Minnesota to testify this morning. He flew out last night. We'll be testifying both in the Senate and also in the House this afternoon, I believe in Representative Barnhart's committee. So you'll get an opportunity to hear from him. The sweetest part about this is that little clawback provision. I just absolutely love that piece. Minnesota, when they implemented this law, it was first vetoed by the governor the first time they did it, and then the governor saw the light and supported the bill the next time around. And actually, Minnesota has one of the most conservative governors they've had in a long while now, followed Jesse Ventura, and he loves their provisions where they have accountability. Absolutely loves it. And we're going to have testimony, and you'll have testimony today about how Minnesota is actually booming. And so making businesses accountable for the money we give away is not going to hurt recruiting business to your state. So I love the clawback provision. It says if you don't do what you signed a contract saying you were going to do, we're going to bring the money back. Because I don't know about you, but I just came off the campaign trail, very tough campaign, was out there on the street for months in the heat and the dark of the night and the early hours of the morning and all day, and almost everyone I talked to says, what are you doing with the money up there? They think we're flush with money and we're not being accountable for it. So we can't get voters to support bond measures in our local communities. We can't get them to support spending for social service programs because we're giving the money away and we're not tracking accountability. So, yes, my senator on that side, my Senate colleague, Senator Farioli, was quoted in the paper as saying this is passive-aggressive behavior to require this accountability, and you might as well put a scarlet letter on these companies. Well, yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I say put a scarlet letter of A. A is for accountability, and that's what we're about here. So thank you for letting me rant and rave this morning. It got me all warmed up for my hearing that's coming up, and I appreciate it. If you go forward, I would also encourage you to take a look at Senate Bill 783, which some of the local unions asked me to draft, which is called Building Oregon Responsibly, and it requires some very good labor issues if you're going to be in an enterprise zone. Before you dig that dirt, we need to make sure that we're taking care of labor and doing it right and making sure they have health insurance and all the things that are important, and that we're not giving away the store to these companies who are in violation of the law in other parts of the state, which the federal government does all the time. Those contractors, Hallie Burton and other contractors over in the Iraq War, just really they're getting lots of handouts from the U.S. taxpayers, yet they owe money and they've done bad things, but there's no accountability. We can do that here in Oregon.
Thank you very much, Senator Walker. Do you have time for a quick question?
I do. We start in 5 minutes, so I do have a couple of moments for questions. Thank you.
Committee members?
Oh,
you pretty well summed it up.
I think I've stunned them all.
So that she has a question. Senator, are you opposed to this bill?
And the political advisor, is gone. Yes, very much so. Very, very much so. We don't need to be adding more of these. And we actually have 55 e-zones. I don't know where he gets 57. I could be wrong. But I would also direct you to this report. I've done a lot of study on this stuff. This is from the Legislative Revenue Office. It's research report number 3-06, Oregon's Enterprise Zone Program. Give you information about how it started. And, you know, one of my colleagues got that goofy e-commerce zone in the Enterprise Zone statutes a couple of years ago. And I've made it my goal to vote against every e-zone measure in the Capitol, but unfortunately, last session, we had one that helped the Murphy Plywood Company, so darn it, they stuck it in there, and I had to vote for that thing because it was important to rebuild Murphy. But I'm okay as long as we've put a lot of sideboards here and there. There are no sideboards. Contrary to popular opinion, there are no sideboards.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator. Certainly appreciate your comments. And, well, you're a great leadoff batter here in the morning.
All right. Well, if you'll excuse me, now that I'm all warmed up, the fire's breathing, I'll move down to the next room. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Vicki Walker, my hero on Enterprise Zones. Really, really tough to follow her on this issue. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon in opposition to House Bill 3298. Let me be clear. When Representative Bruin said we're a little concerned, we're more than a little concerned about Enterprise Zones. Our board of directors has made this issue, along with urban renewal, its number one priority for the legislative session, and we will continue to do that until we feel that we have enacted enough sideboards and enough accountability in these programs where, or some legislative clarification about what the legislature intends the purpose of these programs to be. My comments will be specific to urban or enterprise zones today. You have Portland State Study. Our board invested in an independent study by Portland State University to examine the efficacy of enterprise zones, what exactly is occurring in these zones, how does the department evaluate giving an enterprise zone. And frankly, what our association has come down to on this issue is the legislature needs to either redefine what the purpose and the intent is of the Enterprise Zone program, or I agree, just grant a statewide construction in progress property tax exemption. Eliminate. I love Bob. Bob's great. Bob's a great guy. I love his department. I don't like his program. His program could be completely eliminated. The entire Enterprise Zone program could be completely eliminated if you just granted a statewide construction in progress property tax exemption across the board. Stop having winners. Stop having losers. Stop creating all this red tape of filing for an E-zone and holding all these public hearings. If you're going to give the tax break to everybody, just do it. And we wouldn't actually object to that. In the past, you'd see local government, particularly special districts, come and object. We don't want a property tax exemption. Please don't preempt our property taxing authority. Last legislative session, we were very concerned about the bill that passed that added the 10 new E-zones. We pursued provisions to allow special districts to opt out. When the statement is made that these are local dialogues and local decisions, they are. From a city and a county perspective. From a special district's perspective, they are not. We do not have veto authority over our property tax exemptions that are given away. We just have to suck it up and take it. And we fundamentally disagree with that on so many levels. I don't think the cities and counties would like for us to come in and with legislation to pat ourselves on the back about creating good jobs and say, oh, don't worry, it's only 3 to 5 years, and say, we'll give you your money back. We know what's best. In some areas of the state of Oregon, our rural fire protection districts are the sole service provider for fire protection. In the rural and the metro area, Beaverton, Tuolumne Valley Fire and Rescue, serving 8 cities. We're providing that fire protection. Cities aren't full service anymore everywhere. So I can get quite fired up on this issue also, but I haven't had as much coffee as Senator Walker today, so I'll just direct you to my testimony. It's true. We're talking about a lot of money. $1.3 billion was exempt from the tax rolls, which resulted in an $18.6 million tax giveaway. due to the Enterprise Zone program in 2005 and 2006. I just direct you to the first page of my testimony. We believe, you know, what has originally was a program to benefit and enhance rural Oregon, and let's be clear about that. This program was started in 1985 to benefit rural Oregon. We have 55 zones now in Gresham and Hillsboro, and that's not rural Oregon. And it's disadvantaging those rural communities to have so many enterprise zones and so few, the loopholes and the way you can jump through to get an enterprise zone is very simple. And so if it truly is your goal to stimulate the economy and have a proliferation of enterprise zones, then just grant a construction and progress exemption. Just do it statewide. Or create a whole statewide e-zone and quit making the department go through a lot of bureaucratic red tape with the cities and counties and quit picking winners and losers. And most importantly, adjust your legislative findings that say, especially in those communities at the center of or outside major metropolitan areas, that's where you're trying to stimulate economic growth. That's what your legislative findings say, ORS 285C055. Adjust it. Who loses in this game? If you turn to page 2 of my testimony, special districts are only 10% of the roll. So the argument that of the property tax roll. So the argument that these businesses they may not want to come in if the special districts were able to opt out of these zones. We're 10% of the roll on average statewide. Schools, 45%, and I think that speaks for itself. You're giving away the schools' money. You're giving away your money that you backfill to the schools. Some of the findings that the Portland State study pointed out. Local investment increases show cities with zones are growing at a slower pace than cities without zones. The cost per job created is quite high compared to other states. In 2002, the cost per job created was $23,000. In 2003, $72,000. And in 2004, $88,000. In 2005, $61,000. We're talking about a lot of money to create one job. The exemption period that is granted from, it's a 3-year standard exemption. You can add an additional 2. What we've seen, their exemption period is lengthening. It's just growing. It's now, in 2005, it's about 4.42 on average. So it's not really a 3-year exemption. It's a local choice for the communities to add that additional 2. But it is getting, creeping up to the maximum level of 5. We don't believe that there's any independent data analysis of the program impacts, and there is no independent verification of investment and job creation figures. This is a very important point. No independent verification. This is self-reported data, and if you read the study in its entirety, it will show that the Employment Department's numbers do not match. As far as how many jobs are created, they do not match with Economic Development Department's numbers. That's a problem. Those are the types of sideboards we'd like to see you address.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. In what way do they not match? Could you describe that just briefly?
I'd have to.
And is employment numbers lower or higher than development's numbers?
If you just give me 1 second.
Thank you.
I apologize. It's a lengthy report.
Well, I mean, you're making an important point.
Yes, and it is.
And the issue is,
yes.
is it a valid point or not? And that, I think that might answer the question.
It is a valid point, and it's quite a shocking number. And you know what? I just can't get to it.
I will
provide the committee with that information.
Thank you.
So some of our recommendations that we would like to see is, number one, would absolutely like to see you clarify what the zone program objectives are. Read those legislative findings. Match them up. Either it's about rural Oregon or it's not. Even if it's not, that's fine. Just say that it isn't. We would like the ability for special districts to be able to opt out of these zones. Many of you who've been around will recall this discussion for several legislative sessions. We'd like to mandate companies and zone sponsors to produce verification of investment and job creation figures that can be verified by independent entities. We'd also like zone sponsors to conduct a cost-benefit analysis that includes not only the impact of new investment, but the impact of property tax exemptions on zone sponsors and affected taxing districts. We also believe that the legislature should set a maximum tax subsidy per job created. At some point, you just say, $50,000, $20,000, what is it? What is the maximum amount of tax subsidy that we're willing to do to give to create one job? And then finally, because machinery and equipment is subject to such rapid depreciation schedules and it doesn't provide community benefit, in our opinion, it shouldn't be exempt from taxation under the Enterprise Zone program. Those are my comments. We've already heard that there are four E-zones that are still available. Please don't add 10 more.
Thank you very much, Hasina. Questions or comments? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hasina, thank you for your testimony, and after Senator Walker's testimony, it just brings up some issues I've also read about, and I became somewhat alarmed by the cost we were spending in government revenue, tax dollars, for each job that we create. And it kind of appeared to me that there was also an issue with us not really realizing that when we take give those abatements at the local levels away, that it also puts some pressure on our state dollars to help out our cities and counties in their shortfalls in many programs, because they readjust their budgets. That does affect some of our monies that we pass through. So I think that you've raised some great issues and concerns for this committee and the legislature to really think about. Because one of the items I also read, because often the time things we hear about is that we need to do these sorts of things to entice businesses and industries, and certainly that happens all over the country, and you get into a competitive bidding war with other states, and how much can a state give away to entice more businesses? And when there is, it seems to me, I think from the things I've read, there's really not exactly any evidence that the sole decision for an industry or a business to move to an area is based on the amount of tax giveaways they can receive. So it kind of seems like we're giving away money with just kind of a hope that it's going to have a positive result for our state. And sometimes maybe it does, but I think maybe we ought to be a little more sure about our investment and what return we're getting. So I appreciate your thoughts and your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, the Economic Development Department's own data will show you that they expect, it's that old adage, if you build it, will they come? If you give the tax break, will they still come? Will they or won't they? Their own data shows 50% of the businesses they factor in, they'll come anyway, without the E-zone. Representative Witt, one additional thing. Representative Barnhart, on page 38 is the data regarding the Employment Department data. 63 of the firms had total employment levels generally consistent with the self-reported data. However, 20 of the 83 firms, which is 24%, had total employment levels that were lower than what had been reported in Enterprise Zone reports. And there's some additional statistics there on that information.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When in the 1990s, when the Hynix and the Samsung, they tried to come to our state, we were competing around the world. Even within the United States, we were competing in Utah and Colorado and Texas and plus other states to attract the business. Without such tool like the SIP program and Enterprise E program, sometimes it is difficult for them to bring the company to our state. The information we have, even though they might not pay full 100% of property tax, still they pay some. And then when they pay income tax goes to education, which is total education cost in our state is more than 60% of our total general funding. So all the information you are talking about is not absolutely, it seems to me all negative, not positive. Even in Eugene, in city alone, 6% of total tax revenue coming from the Hynix one company alone. So this is a big company we are talking about, including more than 1,000 people working in there, more than minimum wage. And so I'm concerned that, you know, even last session when I was the chair of the Trade and Economic Committee, we expanded to 10 more, exempting the special district. But I'm also concerned that adding the 10 more at this time, whether it's a good thing or not, I don't have any full knowledge of it. But let's make sure that we continue to attract the companies around the state, around the country, come to our state business friendly. We don't want to give the impression this is not the state business friendly. And so I don't want to give the impression to any of the companies in our state, in our country, around the world. So just want to give my just a comment. Maybe can you comment on my comment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, let me make it clear that SDIO is not anti-economic development. We are not anti-enterprise zone. We seek reform to the enterprise zone program. Clearly, there are projects both within urban renewal and enterprise zones, they're worthy projects that if you hadn't incented, they probably wouldn't have come. So we're not attempting to be anti-business. We just think that there are some program controls that could be put in place, and what program, your legislative findings don't match what you're trying to accomplish. If it's rural Oregon, it's rural Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that actually we didn't exempt the special districts. There was a bill which would have done that. I was in favor of that bill. Unfortunately, I lost that one. And the argument, of course, was that if the special districts opt out, then the companies will not be as likely to come. There was another argument which said we don't want to have to say to the company, oh, everyone's doing this except the fire district. Everyone's doing it's all or nothing. Okay. And that bill failed, if you remember correctly.
Thank you.
Representative Holding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more item. I think one of the things that we're perhaps missing, and to follow up with Representative Lim, is, you know, of course we're creating jobs, and we all want to do that, and those jobs create revenue for the state. And, you know, their average wage, you know, hopefully is around the average wage for the state of Oregon or higher. But I guess I think if the statistics are accurate in this study, just as I've quickly looked at it, if in fact we're spending $61,000 to create a job that pays $61,000, you know, the revenue on income tax going back to the state is substantially less than the $61,000 we spent. So I think that's the kind of thing we really need to look at as this committee. Are we getting a return on our investment? And clearly, if we're investing $61,000 and we're getting the income tax revenue, which runs this state and helps provide the programs for our cities and counties and things that are basically paid by the wage earners, you know, it doesn't look like that that pencils out to me as an investment. So I think that's the one of the big points that we really need to get a handle on.
Representative Dolan.
Hassini, have you talked to any of the enterprise zones on both sides of the issue? And where I'm going with this is I tend to agree with you. We need some sideboards. And after the process is all over, if Hassina hasn't talked to somebody, I would certainly like to. Because when you're sitting at the table and your unemployment rate is 14%. You lead the state. The state leads the nation. And you're Washoe County. You play the game one way. When you come out of the game and you have a large enterprise in your community, and the community's chirping, and you got a new light at the intersection, because we now have 10 cars instead of none, you look back and say, did we make a good buy? So that's the reason for the question. I'd like to know, start to finish, if there is buyer's remorse, what is it and how can we help that? If there isn't buyer's remorse, then I really want to know that too, because Google coming to the Dalles 2 years ago in this session when it was announced, it changed the whole complexion of our community. We went from depressed to exuberant, but that doesn't mean we bought a perfect vehicle. So have you talked to anybody?
Representative Witt, members of the committee, no, I haven't had conversations with zone managers if they had buyer's remorse or if they think it's a good idea or a bad idea. Our issues are more philosophical, and we're not at the table, frankly. We're not at the table to make the decision, and we're not in any position to decide whether or not it was a good or a bad thing. We're just along for the ride. I think your district is a prime example of how this program has run amok. Would you, if you're a business, would you rather go to Gresham, where there's infrastructure, highway access, freeway access? I mean, there's all kinds of things in Gresham. Or would you rather go all the way out, trek on all the way out to Washoe County?
I'd love to trek out to Washoe County.
Well, most businesses, with all due respect, would probably pick Hillsborough. They'd probably pick Gresham. They'd probably pick Clackamas County. It's easier.
That's what we call cluster.
Yep.
Hasina, what about the merits of pledges of corporate responsibility as sideboards, that they would abide by existing laws that regulate child labor, a pledge to abide by environmental protections, pledges to seek and pay family levels of wages and benefits, those sorts of things. Is there perhaps an opportunity here to develop the very kind of sidebars that many of us would like to see?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I think all those things are great things. They're unfortunately not my area of expertise in corporate responsibility. I'd probably, ask AOI or someone else to address those. I think those are good things. I think there are other things that probably from a local community perspective could be adopted. They're not such global items that would also go hand in hand with those.
Any thoughts on clawback provisions?
55 zones. How can you claw that back?
Well, if there are commitments made to increase employment in the community, to stimulate the local economy, to create jobs over X number of years, to hire so many people per year, all of those things, those are commitments made, presumably to take advantage of the tax abatements. Might it be appropriate to put into effect clawback provisions if those terms aren't upheld?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm sensitive to Representative Lim's comments that we don't want to disincent business.
I understand.
And the more of those types of... I see our issues mm-hmm. as easier issues to address than corporate responsibility and child labor, and just probably because of my little micro analysis of the world when it comes to local government. But whatever it is that you did choose to do, we would not want it to hurt a business that was contemplating coming by enacting some, pretty stringent, what you're talking about are pretty stringent, bold, sweeping changes to what we currently have.
Possibly subject to challenge by international trade law anyways. So, with that, any further questions or comments? Hasina, thank you very, very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Next, I'd like to call up, please, Bob Repine and Kyle Gorman. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. I am Bob Riefine, Director of Oregon Economic Community Development, here to talk to you about House Bill 3298 that's in front of you today, which has really a very limited modification that's being considered by this committee. It's the question of, do we extend enterprise zones? It added an additional 10 enterprise zones to the current law. I wanted to just confirm from the sponsor's perspective the numbers we have, and I'm going to go back to the office because we keep bouncing these numbers around a little differently, but our records indicate we have 55 designated zones today. We have currently 4 zones in reserve today. And based on the current application that is underway today for enterprise applications, knowing that there's going to be 10 zones sunsetting or removing their designation, we believe that the current queue or applications that are coming in will probably fill those 10 and still leave us 4 zones readily available for future rounds. So there is a falling off of zones and new ones coming on. So currently in the process we have, we believe that we have ample supply of the zones. Now, subject to whether or not you think 4 is, as you heard the number, the debating was at 30, 20, or 10. Is it 4 is a good reserve? I don't know. I can't tell you that. Haven't been in the agency long enough, but it appears to be a cycling process that allows zones to come on and zones to come off, and we've been able to keep up with that and manage it. But again, suggesting the action that this assembly took last session, when you add a 10, if you do the math, that would mean we probably needed the extra 10 because we still only have 4 in reserve of the 10 that you actually gave us last time. So, you know, maybe there's another number that might work. I don't know. And then so, again, it appears on the surface today we have ample supply of zones. I also thought I'd point out just some other debate that's going on. We, the agency, sponsored a bill this session. It's been heard in the Senate side, Senate Bill 150. And it's a bill that actually dealt with another issue that probably is more more appropriate concern about enterprise zones. The current sunset of enterprise zones, it takes effect as 2009. We introduced a bill that would suggest that the sunset clause be moved up to 2021. I understand today the chair of that committee, Senator Metzger, is going to be introducing amendments to the bill that would move the sunset to 2014 as one issue. And then the other issue that the senator is asking is much to what some of the debate you had earlier off the topic of this bill, but in the general context of enterprise zones, that the agency do to participate in this biennium, this coming biennium, to do a more of a analytical look at enterprise zones to establish the facts and figures as to what it pertains to the winners and losers, the pluses and minuses to the enterprise activities that we have in the state of Oregon. So from what I understand, Mr. Chair and committee members, that is another dash amendment that the chair of that committee is going to be introducing. Today, also, just as a point of reference, there will be some discussion on a bill that was introduced by Senator Walker today on Senate Bill 518 that is kind of taking a bigger step back on much of the activities around enterprise zones and SIP zones to find out whether or not the information and the gains of Oregon is appropriate. Is there appropriate sideboards on these zones and these activities? What are the obligations that we should be expecting both from the state of Oregon, and what are the obligations that we should be expecting and fulfilled by the businesses that enter into these zones in these zoned areas? So there's a series of bills, Mr. Chair and committee members, that are going on in the building simultaneously along with this bill. Again, this bill talks about adding 10 more designations for enterprise zone. Appears today, in summary, we have 4 in reserve. We have applications coming in for 10 that will be sunsetting or removing their designation this term, and we have 10 applications coming in at this point in time, which we think is, we know the communities that are coming in, because they've pretty well had to somewhat disclose prior to making their application known to us. So at this point in time, we think we still will have 4 in reserve at the end of this round.
Thank you very much, Bob. Questions or comments for Director Riefine? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. We've been listening to quite a conversation today about the business of, I think it's been referred to as sideboards for enterprise zones. I can tell you that, as a preface to my question, that I don't want to disarm. Disarming meaning ending the practice of using enterprise zones. I also don't want to pay too much. What's your view, if you have one, about working on sideboards that make sure we don't overpay.
Mr. Chair, committee members.
And that if people don't keep their promises, that we can get our money back.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart and committee members, let me just generally answer the question. There are sideboards. There are actually sideboards that I can attest to relative to the example that the chair represented in his region of a company that's putting a paper machine in, that at the same time as the witness referenced that the same company is laying off people. That earlier confusion of capitalization for that company, which constituted those jobs that were now being laid off, are subject to clawbacks, of which they have been put on notice by the county that they have an amount of money that's going to have to be paid back if they don't live up to the continuation of the obligation that they were faced with for the completion of the investment and the retaining and holding of those jobs for the prescribed period of time. So we do have clawback provisions. I can't answer to some of the specifics that were generalized here at this side of the witness table, but there are clawback provisions that the state have. And I think the spirit of Senate Bill 518, as Senator Walker's introduced it, is to try maybe to get a better disclosure of what are those clawback provisions and how do we facilitate those. We will be, not myself, because I'm going to be doing Ways and Means at 1 o'clock this afternoon, but my deputy director, Mike Salzgiver, will be presenting those components of our base contracts for our programs that we have that have clawback provisions.
And in the interests of fairness, Bob, you've prompted me here with respect to that, the installation of that particular paper machine. No one actually lost a job. All of the employment, quote unquote, loss was handled through attrition, and in fact, are anticipating increased employment due to the addition of yet another paper machine. So one machine has led to an additional one, and we're going to be close to probably $2 billion of investment in the local economy as a result. So
let's see. You have Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chairman. I actually have a couple questions that are real brief. I just need to be brought back up to speed. On urban renewal districts, can they go into enterprise zones?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I quite frankly can't tell you. My suspicion is they can't, but I might be incorrect on that.
Okay. Second kind of observation, when I was here in 93, it was pretty specific for rural areas. Why are we going into major metropolitan areas that don't seem to need the benefit of an enterprise zone?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, representative, again, some of this predates me, so I guess I'm not going to be the right, most sophisticated answer for this, but I think in some of the areas when we talk about urban areas, where you seem to be going in, they also are redefining those some as distressed urbanized areas. And so in the case of metropolitan Portland, there are some enterprise areas that are very specific to highly densified areas, highly urbanized areas, but the nature of the dynamics of the of that part of the community would be considered as distressed. So we have those going on. As it relates to the enterprise zones that are formulated in the Hillsborough area or the Washington County area, my only recollection is, depending on when they became enterprise zones, that maybe there was a designation, some designation, be it federal or some designation, that might have arguably said that it was still considered to be a rural area. That line gets somewhat blurred in the state of Oregon. You don't go too far from urban areas to get into the rural areas. And again, not being that familiar with the criteria, I can't tell you how they were placed in the urbanized or in the enterprise zones.
You have a follow-up on his question.
Please.
Thank you. I'm a little bit familiar with the Hillsborough one, and I thought it was very recent. I thought it was last year. So in not remembering what happened last year, maybe you could check that out, because my understanding is that I'm from Hillsborough, that we got that last year. And I was curious at the time, and so I checked into that, and the area that is designated as an enterprise zone in Hillsborough is what I would call a depressed area. Hillsborough is, in general, is not a depressed area. It's a very driving economic engine out there. But that particular small area where they put the enterprise zone is a depressed area in that area. But I believe it went in last year.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Riley, again, I think if I remember correctly, that zone was just coming in when I was coming in the building, too. Again, that's not necessarily an excuse. I would be more than happy to find out the criteria that were used in the placement of the Hillsborough facilities and get back to the committee staff on that.
Don't take it away, by the way.
Oh, I wasn't planning on it.
Representative Dolan.
Yes, I'm very interested in the criteria for stressed also, and we'll be welcoming that information. One of the things I want to ask, Bob, is have you talked to those that presently have an enterprise zone and asked them what they might do differently on this side of the equation? As I said earlier, the circumstances are certainly different on one side, but do we have any notion? Is there buyer's remorse, or is that...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dillon, committee members, I think when you have a program like this that lies out all around the state of Oregon, there's 55 of those zones. You probably have winners and losers and people who like what they did and are satisfied with the results. You have some that maybe at the end of the day, they didn't, after they seen what actually came about because of the enterprise zone, that were not as satisfied with it. We have, not that letters mean a lot, but we have letters from many participants in the enterprise zones, municipalities to special district partners who've said, we appreciate the fact that there's an enterprise zone and we value that activity. I think it depends on where you're talking about in the state, how it's affecting them, and how does it affect their county and their community in general.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Colby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, you had mentioned that we have clawback provisions already for enterprise zones, and I guess my question is, does the state have specifics on what those clawbacks are, what they should be, or is it something that is just left up to the zone manager, the local officials to determine whether they want to have a clawback and what those should be?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Holvey, it is my understanding that many of the clawback provisions, again, relative to enterprise zones, I can't specifically talk about how they come about, but in our other loan documents that we have for other program dollars, those are ones that are directed and controlled by this agency as to what will be considered to be the trigger mechanism if you do not live up or comply with the conditions of either the grant or the award. As the enterprise, my recollection is that there are specific deliverables that the company has to meet. And in order to go from the three-year time that you heard the earlier witness talk about to going to a five-year window of time for enterprise exceptions, there are requirements of creating jobs at a certain 150% median area average wage. You have to do certain performance activities that if you don't do, you would be subject to clawback provisions that are in those enterprise zones.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So I'm just want to follow up with that. So do we have specific clawback requirements, or are they negotiated for each individual project?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Holy, with all honesty, I can't tell you whether or not it's based on the zone, whether or not the provisions are designed specifically to the zone, or is it designed to each of the applicants that come in. But in generally, I think pretty much in most cases, there's always a clawback provision that relates to the business's time and terms within that enterprise designation.
And with an eye towards time management, I'm going to cut this line of questioning off. Director Repine, thank you very, very much for being present and for answering our numerous questions. Mr. Gorman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kyle Gorman. I'm the executive officer for Clackamas County Fire District Number 1, which is one of the largest fire districts in the state. We extend from the city of Portland south to Molalla, from the Willamette River east to and including a portion of the city of Damascus, and on the southeast side we actually bump up against the Mount Hood National Forest. So I tell people we have the best elk hunting of any urban fire department in the state or in the nation. We cover significantly urban and rural areas. The question before you today is whether the state should approve additional enterprise zones in Oregon. We don't believe so. Well, we don't believe so because we're not entirely sure that they work. And all of the peer-reviewed published literature regarding enterprise zones and urban renewal, for that matter, suggest that these type of economic incentives really don't work. And you will hear anecdotes from a number of proponents of enterprise zones and other tax abatement programs that they do work, and they're very popular. The reality is the literature does not support those anecdotal issues. What we believe it takes to entice business is great services. You know, business needs to have telecom, they have to have water, they have to have power, they have to have transportation. Business needs to have the protection of local fire services. They have to have an educated and available workforce. And if those factors of production are available, we believe that business will come to Oregon and come to our localities. If those factors of production are not available, we don't think that any amount of tax abatement will be beneficial. Even if urban renewal did work, and even if enterprise zones did work, they force an undue requirement to pay for enterprise zones on fire districts. The one local district that's almost entirely supported by property taxes. So any impact on property taxes affects us a great deal. We serve five cities, and any one of those five cities could presumably establish an enterprise zone, and we would be forced to provide a greater amount of protection for less money. The problem is that the cost goes far beyond the dollars. It goes beyond the protection. It goes to the protection. We must serve these additional areas, and in some cases they are very, very expensive to serve. I'm not sure how much it costs to serve $250 million paper fabrication center, but my guess is that it's a great deal of concern for your local fire services in that area. Proponents sometimes argue that enterprise zones are beneficial because they add additional taxes to the rolls. Our concern is with machinery and equipment. That's quite simply not true. M&E depreciates at a significant rate, and that rate varies among zones. We just had an enterprise zone go into our area for $25 million for capital improvements, and 23 of those $25 million were M&E investments, which means that by the time the five-year period is up, the amount that's actually returned to the rolls for the additional level of effort that we have to contribute is quite small, not nearly what it was when it went in. So we don't think that additional enterprise zones are necessary. We have a great deal of concerns about how they're constructed right now, and we think that the legislature would be better served to think about how we can improve the services that are delivered to business rather than offering a more simplistic tax rebate approach.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to belabor the point, but suppose a business of a significantly different nature in terms of structure and the kind of fire protection needs that it might have comes into a fire district, perhaps one more rural than yours even. Is it potentially the case that the fire district might need to buy new and expensive equipment to be prepared to deal with emergencies in a plant that was significantly different from the kinds of enterprises that were already in existence there.
Absolutely.
And that that might be very expensive to do.
Absolutely, Representative Barnhart and Chair Witt. And not only that, but it may be that the business simply couldn't move there if the fire agency resources weren't available to provide the protection that they needed for that type of business, because the hazard taxes, the fire or the hazard insurance, would be so expensive that they just simply wouldn't be able to afford it given the level of protection that's available.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Additional questions or comments? Mr. Gorman, thank you very much. Certainly appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify today on House Bill 3298? Going once, please. Good morning, Doris.
I'm Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties, and I've been involved in the discussions of these issues for a lot of years. I've been with the association for the last couple of years and represent the counties all over the state that are zone sponsors with cities and ports. Last legislative session, you will recall the same discussion. At the end of the session, the Enterprise Zone Statute, which is voluminous, required that when you put a zone into place, every taxing district in the area is notified, and they are allowed to come in and, in a public meeting, talk about whether it would be a benefit or not to your area. In addition to that, administrative rules of the department also require or suggest that, even though it's not in the statute, that if there are major investments in a zone, that you make sure that the zone, taxing districts are aware of this business coming into the zone so that you can indeed know what the impact on services are. In many, many zones around the state, because of it's important that a business is served. And they have code requirements. They have to meet certain requirements in order to be in business. The businesses do site agreements with special districts, particularly fire districts, to be sure that the service is provided when the new employees and the new businesses are operating. And I know the department has a lot of information on those site agreements that are in place. I'm not sure that the statute requires that, but I know that in urban zones, the statute allows that when you establish a zone, you can have further arrangements in your zone beyond what the statute requires, so that if there are other things that urban areas really feel they need to do, they put it in the zone implementation. The final thing I'd like to say is that the zones... the zone law is huge, and the clawback provisions are specific to the statute. You either meet the requirements of employment and it be a traded sector business, or you can't get the provisions, so it's all in the statute. And we've had, over time, investments that didn't turn out to be what they might be, and in some of those cases, they've had to pay back the taxes, the back taxes, for the period when they didn't have the employees that they indicated they would have. So I think the department has a lot of that kind of information. They have an enterprise zone manager, as Mr. Rapine would tell you, and that he spends his life on these kinds of things with the zones around the state. So I think he could give you a lot of specific information that would respond to these questions.
Thank you very much, Doris.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard?
Maybe I can ask you this, the same question I asked Director Repine. Mm-hmm. Can you put an urban or rural district inside an enterprise zone?
the department does not establish, has no connection actually with urban renewal districts. I don't know the specific provisions of that. I know there are people in the room that can answer that question because they have urban renewal districts. But I know that you can't overlay one tax abatement over another. So, there has to be since an urban renewal district does not actually abate taxes, it just sets it aside to pay for certain projects. It's not abated to any business.
Right.
So in an enterprise zone, it is abated for 3 to 5 years, depending on what the business is and how many employees they have. So they operate separately, but there can't be overlays that have a double effect. And I know there is disagreement about whether how it operates is correct or not, but I think you'd have to ask an urban renewal expert. I don't think I'm qualified.
Last question, Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that you said that there's a requirement for public meeting where
yes.
special zones can
all zones
mm-hmm. all zones
mm-hmm.
Can discuss
yes.
What's happening and let their needs be known. I know there are special districts who are not happy with that arrangement. What do you think the result would be if they had opt outs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, I really don't. I think the counties would say that they don't approve of opt-out provisions, and this is why. This is a local discussion among taxing districts, and I know it seems unfair that not everybody can be a zone sponsor, but cities and counties and ports are organized for economic development purposes, and I think that's why they are zone sponsors, and cities and counties are general government. They have to care about everything, the services and the economic developments of the area. If you allow opt-outs, my major concern is that the statute says you can, so you never have to come to the table. You never have to talk to your neighbor. You just don't have to be a part of what's going on in the community. I, for a fact, know that around this state, fire districts and special district representatives get along very well with the cities and the counties and the ports and whatever, and they are able to work these things out. If there is serious opposition, they don't have a zone. And I'm sure there are examples of that having occurred. I know it becomes a little bit more difficult in urban areas, and that's why when they established urban zones, they said that you should have other provisions that are in place that also take care of some of these kinds of issues. So I guess that's my answer. I really don't think statute should say you can opt out.
Doris, thank you
very
much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Last and final call on House Bill 3298. You don't have to go home, but you're not going to get to testify in this bill today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3298. Just a housekeeping matter here. Given our time constraints, we will probably not be hearing House Bill 2264, so if there is anyone that is here for that bill, we are likely going to have to carry that over. And next I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3027. Ellen, if you could please summarize the bill for us.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. I'd first point out this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and what it does is it appropriates $1 million to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department for the purpose of providing business assistance services, including loans, to small businesses and micro-enterprises in rural or distressed communities. It requires OECDD to convene a task force that meets quarterly to coordinate the work of state agencies and to develop a coherent framework for state agency efforts related to small business and micro-enterprises.
And I'd like to call up Valerie Plummer, please. And let's see here. Ray Robinson, please.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Witt.
Good morning.
And members of the committee. I will try to keep this quick because we have a couple of entrepreneurs who have closed their business in order to come to Salem, and so we wanted to make sure they have some time for testimony. My name is Valerie Plummer. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Micro Enterprise Network. I do have some materials for your viewing pleasure. If you have, would it be for Barry or who?
Valerie, if we could have you stand down just for a minute, just remain seated. I'd like to provide an opportunity for Representative Edwards to comment. There should be three seats. Please, Ray, have a seat. Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Witt, committee. I apologize for my tardiness. Wasn't sure you were going to get to the bill today.
I'm certainly glad to have you.
And I appreciate you opening a hearing on this bill. I'm going to be brief, given the time constraints, but I wanted to take the opportunity to talk about the purpose of the bill, and I'll allow Valerie and others to give you the details. But as you probably know, the purpose of the bill is to expand support for microenterprises and underserved and critical subset of businesses. And a microenterprise, per the definition in the bill, is a small business venture with fewer than five employees and generally lacks access to conventional loans, equity, and other banking services. They're likely represented by low-income folks. As defined by the bill, that means about 80% of the federal poverty level in terms of income. They're also largely represented by women and or minority-owned businesses and are operated in rural or distressed communities. And the purpose of the bill is to provide some enhanced funding for a current program through OECDD that will create jobs, enhance entrepreneurial activity, and increase the incomes of disadvantaged households. More specifically, the bill will provide for contracted services to provide training, technical assistance, and micro-lending services. There are, by my reckoning, four primary benefits of the bill. It will capitalize on a program proven to raise the incomes of micro-enterprise entrepreneurs. It will provide the type of incremental investments in early-stage Oregon companies that have outsized impacts. It will encourage the development of successful businesses where we need them most, that is in distressed rural and urban areas. And it will also aid in the creation of the best type of businesses, those that trade regionally, nationally, or even globally, basically ventures that are net importers of dollars as opposed to businesses that only circulate local dollars. So lastly, as a courtesy, if you agree with this bill in principle and your only qualm is the potential budget impact, I urge you to pass it out to Ways and Means and let that committee determine the proper funding level given a comprehensive view of the state's budget. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony and leave it to others to detail past and potential successes of the program.
Thank you, Representative Edwards. Questions or comments from our committee? Certainly appreciate this bill very much and your appearance.
Okay, thanks again.
Thank you.
One question.
Yes, Representative Dolan.
I just received the map, and I see that several counties are omitted. Where do they go for service, and what service level is provided for them?
Valerie, do you want to speak to that?
The funds are available via a competitive grant process, and so the companies that aren't on that map are those that either didn't apply or didn't successfully apply. And so one effort of this bill is to really increase the funds because when they were applied for, we had $1.5 million available and $5.5 million in requests for that $1.5. And so we're really trying to increase the funds so that we can make this statewide so other counties are covered.
Thank you. Valerie, would you like to proceed with your testimony?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. So OMIN is a network of about 45 organizations that provide services to small business owners. And we're located around the state, and our mission is to increase opportunities for disadvantaged entrepreneurs, be they low-income, be they minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, those that are in rural or distressed areas. The map you see is of targeted service providers, and they're called targeted because they're providing services to entrepreneurs that are underserved. They're either, again, minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, or those in rural and or distressed areas. And as I mentioned, the funds are available through a competitive grant process through the department. And as you know, just a bit of a context, and you'll hear from a couple of entrepreneurs, context as far as running a business, and I know some of you are small business owners, and so you're very familiar with this. Our clients are typically very small business owners, and they tend to be their company's human resource manager and CFO and CEO and janitor all wrapped into one, and so they're doing quite a bit. You may not know that 86% of all businesses in the state have five or fewer employees. You may probably know that they are, however, struggling to succeed. And the challenges with competing in a global economy, coupled with the fact that many of those economies, which were traditionally resource-based, are really shifting. Those economies are shifting. And so it's a wonder that small businesses succeed at all. And that's what the targeted service provider's job is. And we are represented by several different organizations. But who are the entrepreneurs that we serve? They're the working poor, folks who are struggling from a low-paying job into hopefully a job that they can transition from and be their own boss and make good decisions as a business owner. The services that we provide are things like training, one-on-one consulting, helping folks write a business plan, helping them access financing, and the funds that are used by the targeted service providers are leveraged. So the 1.5 that we had last biennium, we leveraged that with $10.7 million. And that leverage comes from federal funds, from state funds, from foundations, from charitable donations. And I'd be happy to talk with you about some deliverables and accountability, but I want to make sure that I give all of the folks here a chance to testify. So first off, we'll have Ray Robinson, who's the owner of Telecom Clinic and also Salem Supply Shop. Go ahead.
Welcome to our committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, representatives. I am a small business owner, and I know the struggles, if you will, that we go through to compete, not only to compete, but to make growth in our business so that we can be viable. Without the support of places such as Oregon Association of Entrepreneurs, HDC, different places that we can avail ourselves, our businesses, of, we would fall by the wayside. We have good intentions, of course, but the products that we sell or merchandise or the services we render need the support, an analogy would be a plane getting off the ground. The hardest thing to do is to get up there. It's like an engine, a train, that once you get over the initial inertia, once you get inertia built up, you can keep going. And I've been in business, and because of these places that I've gone, I've gotten counsel, whereas it wasn't available. Oftentimes, entrepreneurs don't get the training they get or that they need in school. They'll teach you math and all the things and the tools that you need, but they don't have a course that says, if you're going to do this on your own, you need to know this. That's not there. So these places are very important, and because of the support, I'm happy to say that my business is still in existence.
Thank you very, very much. Questions, comments from the committee? Yes, Vice Chair Lim, please.
Yes. Could you give me what's the difference between SBDC and the program which you are doing?
Sure. So the small business development centers, they're a network of, I think, 18 or 19 centers around the state. And typically, the targeted service providers work quite closely with the SBDCs. One analogy is that of a baseball diamond. This gentleman used the analogy of getting a plane off the ground. Well, if we think about folks who are swinging the bat and trying to get to first base, that's where the TSPs come in. And then we tend to hand off businesses that are ready for higher growth, and then they can get to second or third base. And so we work quite cooperatively with the SBDCs, and they're funded at quite a bit higher level than the TSPs. We won't get into that. But they do work quite effectively with the TSPs and are available for training and technical assistance to our entrepreneurs. I can note on performance measures, since they are funded by the department as well as the TSPs, we are held to the same performance standards as the SBDCs.
Yes, Representative Colby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm understanding this correctly, this money that's being asked for in this bill, the $1 million, is apparently coming out of the general fund and going to the Economic Development Department to hand over to, I guess, the targeted service providers, basically to fund the targeted service providers to pay their salaries and whatnot, so that they can just help the small businesses in looking for other kinds of help or loans or just helping them get set up in business. Is that essentially
That's
right?
Correct. Yes. It's the general gist of it. Thank you.
Oh, thanks. I just making sure I understood the setup.
And I can, if I can be excused, there are several other folks I believe that would like to testify on behalf of this.
Yes, absolutely.
Representative Witt.
Okay. Thank you very, very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up Sanford Maddox and Brandy Weber, please.
Good morning.
I want to thank the chair and the committee for the opportunity to participate in this process, and I'll try to be very brief. I'm representing the Black United Fund of Oregon's Microenterprise Neighborhood Development Program, which stands for MEN. The MEN program works with small...
Sanford, if you would allow me to just interrupt you for a moment. For the record, would you please state your name?
Sanford Maddox.
Thank you very
Sorry.
Much.
The MEN program works with business clients located in northeast Portland. Our program model provides loans and grants, coupled with a very intense level of technical support, which may include everything from helping the small business implement their business plan to helping clients dress for success to helping a small deli make and actually distribute fresh bagels. We believe our approach, while demanding a high degree of commitment and performance from participants, builds trusting relationships and results in highly supported clients. While some of our clients have struggled to succeed, others have doubled their revenues and net incomes while also creating employment opportunities. Another area that is noteworthy but is not often captured in the statistics is the tremendous increase in self-worth and confidence that we've observed from clients, including those struggling with physical disabilities or other personal and or economic challenges that have kept them from participating in the American dream. This funding will make a significant difference in the lives of many Oregonians, and we hope the state will continue to support small business development. And I brought with me this morning Brandy Weber, who's one of our clients, and she's going to talk to you a little bit about some of the benefits the program has provided for her business.
Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Brandy Weber, owner of Imagination Station Daycare Center. I'll try to be brief. That's one of my problems is I got the gift gab here. So, I've really benefited from the Black United Fund and MEN program. I started early 2002 with an in-home daycare on the other side of my duplex. Very small. We can only have 10 children in in-home daycare. And in late 2005, you know, we had definitely reached our maximum of 10 kids, had a waiting list, and had a need to expand. So in 2005, I met Nita Shaw, and we were enrolled in the MEND program shortly after. And within months, I went from 10 kids into larger space to accommodate 40 children, tripled my revenues from $3,000 to $9,000 a month. It's been awesome. It's been a wonderful learning experience. They not only, provide the funding, but, when I first got enrolled in this program, they sit with you and, you set reasonable goals. They help you with your business plan. They set up a cash flow for you so you can see, how and where your money's going. Not only with just the business plan. I mean, it changes. Your business changes. They will call you every week, every couple of weeks, and even do a surprise visit just to check on you, see what you need, how they can steer you in the right direction, get you right on your path. They want to see you meet your goals. It's more than just taking on a small business loan from a bank or anywhere. It's you're taking on a set of people that want to see you succeed, and they go beyond means to see you get there. And just having that feeling behind you definitely, gives you that confidence and that drive to keep going. So, I would say, having that team of support is definitely one of the most important things I think they offer. The funding that I've received from Black United Funds and the MEND program, been able to upgrade my equipment to more stimulating, attractive toys, redecorating my facility to attract those double-income families, a 12-passenger van to transport my children to and from school, even just being affiliated with the MEND program. I've also been able to acquire additional information from Cascadia and the Mercy Corps program. They're great. They're there for you. As far as the bookkeeping and taxes is another hard part of the job, being self-employed. They're great with technical support and offering you the best ways to go about doing your bookkeeping, which has always been an intimidating factor for me. It's not fun. It's the worst part of my day, but actually now they've got me set up on a program custom made for my business, and I actually look forward to, at the end of the month, seeing where my numbers go and, being in charge of that. It gives you a great sense of self-worth, seeing where your money goes and just doing everything on your business that you can. I think this program is great. It's very beneficial to a lot of small business owners, and it'd be great if it could stick around for a while.
Very good. Thank you so much, Representative Dolan.
Yes, I see, and I think this is was the broadside from you. I'm not sure it doesn't have a name on it, but it says that we had a 40% increase in business survival rate, and it is a micro-lending institution. 40% increase from where? If I were a guarantor at a bank, I'd want to know cure rate on the loans. What is the default rate, the cure rate on the loan you make?
I can't really. I used to be involved in micro-lending, but I'm really not now. The loans that we do are kind of just short-term loans and grants. We try to get the participants in a position where we can actually move them into a traditional lending process. But we have not experienced, and our program is like 18 months old, so I really can't give you a lot of information totally about, Valerie probably could, about what the default rate. I know when I was working with the SBA microloan, I think our default rate was something under 10%, which is pretty good. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we could hear from Valerie what that default rate is.
Valerie? Come on forward, please, if you would. If you'd reintroduce yourself.
Hello again.
Hello.
Chairman. So industry-wide, and these are national standards, we see between 8 and 10% in default rates. In Oregon, we've seen slightly lower. So statewide, we've seen between 7 and 9%. But again, so Omen is a nonprofit, and we're a network, so we don't actually do direct lending. But actually, a gentleman who is signed up to testify from OAMI, the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, has a current lending program, so he could tell you, you know, this moment what their monthly default rate is, if that would be more helpful. But those are just Oregon and national numbers.
Thank you.
And for the record, that latest commentary was from Valerie Plummer from Omen. Representative Holby?
Before she leaves.
You're popular this morning.
Thank you. I was just noticing in the testimony, maybe I didn't hear this, but it also appears that the clients also pay something for the services that are delivered, too. And I guess I didn't hear that the first time through. So I don't know if all clients pay a certain amount for some of the services, or is it just determined on whether or not there's an ability to pay? How does that work?
That's a great question, Chair Witt, Representative Holby. So typically, services are highly subsidized. And so if you have a regular business consultant, you can pay upwards between $100 and $300 an hour, just like a lawyer, any professional type services. And part of the reason why we are such good leveragers of different funding sources is because we don't charge that rate for our services. And so typically for an hour of consulting, folks pay between $10 and $20. And for a training class, like a three-hour workshop on how to write a marketing plan, it's similar, sometimes up to $50. And that's pretty typical nationally, as well as what we see in Oregon. And oftentimes they are in a sliding fee scale, and so we actually used to have three levels of fees. And so if you made up to 200% of the area median income, you would pay the highest level, which would be about $50 a class. And if you made only 100% of the poverty level, you pay about $25.
Yes, Representative Dahlem.
Could you give us some notion, when you look at the loan portfolio, what is the average loan size?
Typically, it's about $7,500. Loans are always, the micro loans are always under $35,000, but typically the need for capital. We don't always encourage folks to take out capital just because debt financing, especially for a small business, it's sometimes like dropping a bag of gold on an eggshell. They're sometimes not ready for it, and so typically the loans range between $5,000 and $15,000, but the average is about $7,500.
And Sanford, would you comment, this capital market that Valerie is describing, I think, is oftentimes not attractive to your regular lending institutions. It may not be worth their while, so to speak. The importance of the fund that you've created, please.
That's a very good question, Chairman Witt. Yes, I'm convinced that you really can't make money with microenterprise lending. The loans are just too small. The banks really can't charge enough interest, and the assistance in helping them work through their business plans, you just can't make enough money out of it. So without these programs, a lot of folk at this level would never have an opportunity to access capital, and that's the real benefit. But one of the things we do with our program, though, we try to get them to that point. So our program acts as a bridge, provides some small loans. And in fact, one of the programs we're working with right now, to get some banks to participate, we will put up a loan guarantee. In other words, we'll put up $5,000 or $6,000 and say, bank, we want to establish a line of credit for this small business client. If they maintain that loan at a satisfactory level for 18 to 24 months, whatever time you think is appropriate, we want to pull that money back out and use it again. So we found that's a nice way to bridge the process to put them into a traditional banking situation.
Representative Dahlem.
Then what you do, you really have a revolving loan account, and when you consider the default rate, you really will be able to sustain yourself in time, I would hope. Yeah.
Yes, yes. We've done very well with our microloan program. I'm thinking, and again, these are very short-term loans. I think we've only had two defaults in the loans so far, probably of the $132,000 that we have distributed in loans or grants, that represents only like $13,000 that we've actually lost. One of those companies hasn't been paying, but they're still in business, so the possibility of getting the money back. What we have emphasized is the protection of the principal, because mm-hmm. we're not charging any interest on our loans.
In Sanford, one thing that I would note, the availability of these relatively small loans then have made it possible for someone like Brandy to triple her revenue in a very short period of time. That's certainly something that no large corporation could ever do and only wish that they could. So extremely important that avenue remain available for entrepreneurs who need it and obviously have been a success story.
Thank you, Chairman.
Anything further? Yes, question. Vice Chair Lim.
Thank you. So if that the loan default rate is about 7 to 9%, in 10 years, the money will be gone. Then where do you replenish the money again?
That's a good question. What we're hoping is that there is enough value in creating new businesses that create wealth, that create jobs, that the state, the city, and even private sector. We have approached the private sector about putting in money. We do have a couple of business owners, business execs who are interested in this program. But I'm hoping that will be the motivation. I don't think you can really make this a money-making process. At least I have not been convinced from my experience with it.
Thank
you. If I may, Representative Lim, Chair Witt, just to add to that, many loan programs do have built into their budget that loan loss reserve. So in case of those losses, they do have that amount of funds available to cover those losses. Additionally, OMIN is starting a statewide loan fund for the benefit of counties that are not on this map that Wells Fargo or no large bank wants to lend to, even if they were in that area. And so we're actually focusing on those small loans in those rural areas and making sure that that loss reserve is built in to our budget. And also anticipating that any interest income that is earned will cover that loss. So again, it's not a money-making venture, but it is filling a real need out there.
Thank you.
Thank you all very, very much. And Brandy, congratulations on such
Thank
a great
you.
Job.
Thank you very much.
Certainly appreciate your traveling all this way to offer us testimony.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Have a great rest of your day.
Representative, I think there might be a couple more who might
yes,
not want to.
Yes, we have okay. At least one more panel here that I'm going to call forward. Sean Winkler, Kirk Frazier, and George Guerra.
Mr. Chairman, are you going to try and move this bill today?
I don't think so.
Okay. I would stay and vote.
Okay. In the affirmative, you're going to move it, but if you're not, I'm going to. We're absent enough members, I'd just feel better if they were all here. I think this has broad support, but thank you for your offer. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Jorge Guerra. Good morning, Chair, and Representative Lim and Holly. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, OAMI, and the President Samuel Brooks sends his regards and apologies for not being here today. But I came to give a testimony that what the meaning on this bill would help the organizations that we're trying to help and are helping small businesses, the microenterprise here in Oregon. OAMI has been active since 1987, and we have the mission to promote and develop entrepreneurship and economic development through the state. We have been doing that successfully and through a core of services that we have, which includes one-on-one technical assistance, advice small businesses, startup businesses, and also we do marketing, we do business opportunities. We have a loan fund for access to capital for those small businesses. And in some of the questions that you have there, OAMI established a loan fund, a macro loan fund, since 1990. too. And we've been successful with that. And just in the last period, the last 2 years, I can mention that we have done 111 loans for $517,000. And the average loan is about $4,500 to $7,000. Yeah, but our loans are from $500 up to $30,000. And we have a pool of money that we can, you know, it's a revolving loan of fund that we can do that. Yes, we charge interest. But the biggest problems on that area is how to follow up the borrowers and how we provide the technical assistance. So the banks, that's why it's not a benefit for the banks to do that type of loans. Why? Because they don't follow up. They just give the money and they expect the money back. Mm-hmm. But we do work with the client and with the small business and see that they have a progress and they keep growing on the business. So that's one of the main keys for a small business, to have that technical assistance, that support, somebody to watch over the shoulders how the business is doing. One of the major programs that OAMI has done through the support of OECD, through the funding that we have received and combining the support and our relationships with other public agencies, local and also federal, is the incubator program. We have the largest incubator program here in the Pacific Northwest. We have a 40,000 square feet building with 37 different companies, 103 businesses in the 103 employees in that building, and many people don't see that, but I can tell you that it's been a successful. A lot of people watch over. You know, they come to see us. In fact, from different areas, in rural areas in Oregon, they come and visit our incubator. Based on that, we developed a smaller incubator in the Gresham area, in the Rockwood area, that was a distressed area, really highly distressed over there a few years ago. We went there. It was, I say, a few years. It was 4 years, almost 5 years already. And we developed a small incubator for 10,000 square feet with seven new tenants. And that was a successful incubator in Rockwood. Anyway, so that's what OAMI has done. The support that it could be with the funds to increase in is not just to cover the payroll for the staff, for the organization to grow, but also the support that the organizations can do to small businesses. OAMI is a statewide organization, and what can we do with additional funding is to increase our visibility and the support to small businesses around the state. We have been we got a donation from an enterprise company to give us a van so we can do a circuit rider, go around the state, go to different communities, go to small communities, to east, west, to the coast, etc., to do that service. So that's what is the main goal, and that's why we're trying to see that you can support this bill.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, let you choose who goes next.
Okay, my name's Kurt Fraser. I'm, as you know, from your town.
Yes. Welcome. Welcome this morning. You've traveled a great distance. I think you win the award for the longest distance here today.
And let's see, I don't have experience at dealing with these type of business help agencies because I'm mainly interested in invention. And these kind of businesses that have been talked about so far are, you know, well, like, setting up a daycare center or a flower shop or whatever like that, you have a product that's already in existence, and it's a matter of, you know, just building on what you have. In the case of, you know, since I prepared this 2 years ago, I'll make a little aside here for Mr. Lim that, you know, if you have a piece of real estate, you know, just an empty lot, all, you know, the way to improve the value of the lot is to build on it, right? And if you have want to build or improve on it further, then you improve the building. So, and eventually, you know, if you still want to try to improve it, you have to invent something new to go in the building. and so, eventually, we improve our standard of living by invention. You know, we wouldn't be here enjoying these lights without somebody inventing them. I know some inventions don't require money, additional money. Like I invented a board game recently, and that was, just a few dollars out of my pocket, and I found that it was not so easy to find people to reproduce the game, but nevertheless, it didn't cost that much just to invent it. There are other inventions that require a lot more money, and they also require a lot more help. I've spent about 15 years working on a robot, which I believe will eventually produce a nice business, but it's still not finished, and it may take another 5 years. If I was a student at Newberg High School, I could probably be done by the time I got out of high school, because they have a nationally recognized program in robotics. And I don't have the help that the students there have. And I've had to, come up with ideas and talk with people in industry and people and hire people through the now defunct Oregon Advanced Technology Consortium program to get on my way with the project. And that kind of, expensive invention, I guess, does require some equipment and resources to put together. In the old style, idea of a independent garage inventor, which pretty much I am, the inventor lives in poverty, puts their own resources at high risk, and puts the you have to put your attention at more than one invention in order to have a diversified portfolio, so to speak, so that you can hope that one of them is going to succeed. And the corporate model, corporate inventors are well-funded with high personal income, all the equipment they need, and legal resources to obtain patents, and that's why Intel, Hewlett Packard, and other corporations aren't here speaking about this bill, because they're all set. I would like to see both more money and more help for inventors. The gentleman who was from Salem speaking about his business said that they teach you math in high school, but they don't teach you what you need for business, how to apply it for business. I totally agree with that. even recently I took a course in electronics to try to learn that part of my project, and it's the same problem. I learned a lot about electronics I didn't know before, but I'm still having to hire outside help to accomplish my project. In this case, it's from Russia. If there were, it seems like there's a disconnect between not only the legislature, but the teachers and the invention process, to where the inventor needs to be told, okay, this is going to cost you a $100,000 test before it's completed, otherwise you won't be allowed to market it, just because of the government regulations on pesticides or something. Because I had an idea for a pesticide product once and found that out. If I would have known that early, I wouldn't have bothered. there's all kinds of little decisions that a person needs help on, and I've been able to get a little bit from an organization called Applied Industrial Technologies, which is a vendor of industrial equipment over in Longview and other parts of the area. One of their guys helped me a great deal with one particular valve, which I now use exclusively. He even recommended it outside his company before he knew his company could get it. There's another fellow that's even more senior there that provided help that keeps seems to keep costing me money and not helping. and so there's need for both help and money and for inventors. And I'm saying that invention is what, you know, drives their standard of living. And therefore, if we made an effort to make everybody an inventor in the state, we'd have a great economy. we could look at the federal program of, you know, Small Business Innovation Research, which funds ideas that are basically given by the government. You know, you have a certain need to fulfill, and you make out an application, and they decide that about 13% roughly are approved and the rest are not approved. And so you put a man-week's worth of work in to find out that, you know, you're not approved. And so even in that, I've tried using help that was available from some people that had some success in the SBIR program. And I attended Senator Wyden's meeting on the project that was in Oregon on SBIR, and somehow or other I've still not had any success with SBIR. But I think that combining some of the features of these various bills, the SBIR program and the old Oregon Advanced Technology program that used to be here in the state, could come up with something that would be very productive in terms of the economy. Some people that I talked to in trying to recruit more people to show up today would disagree with some of the things I said, but on the other hand, they did agree with the idea that if you look at what the government does with their money, if you lost $99 out of 100 due to bad investments in inventions that didn't pan out and that sort of thing, you'd still be ahead of adding to another layer to the government. I guess that's the essence of my argument.
Thank you very much, Mr. Frazier.
Thank you.
I didn't think I was going to make it.
Good morning.
Representative Lynn, Chair Witt, excuse me, thank you for staying until the end. I genuinely appreciate the opportunity to address you both. I would like to address the committee as a whole, but hopefully they'll look at the tape or they'll hear from both of you. My name is Sean Winkler-Rios. I'm the Executive Director for Lane Microbusiness in Eugene, and I really want to get to the heart of this bill, which I still don't think has been touched on yet. You heard a lot earlier about enterprise zones and about attracting industries and jobs to Oregon. This bill is about meeting the need that's already there. In every rural community in Oregon, there are people that have visions of a small business, entrepreneurs, and they're just trying to figure out how to do it. Yesterday, I taught a class in McMinnville. The week before that, I was out in Burns Hines, Bend, Redmond, and Pendleton. Why all the rubber on the road? Because these people had needs that weren't being met. I think one of the things we need to be clear about is that when a service provider draws a geographic boundary around a county, that doesn't necessarily mean that all the needs are being met there. And there are a lot of needs out there, and especially in these rural communities. Our particular organization, we serve Latinos, people with disabilities, and rural communities. My address, 1445 Willamette, is the same address as the Business Development Center. We are their rural outreach strategy. That's how they talk about us. The director is on my board. They can't serve all the needs out there. And TSPs are a fancy name for business development specialists. It means not only do we have to have the knowledge and skills in starting, stabilizing, and growing a business, but we have to know the rules about Social Security so people's benefits don't get cut. We have to know how to deal with people in rural communities. who just want a lifestyle or to stay there because they love it there, or the cultural differences because people are from another country. So those are the types of things we do, and the need is tremendous. In fact, I think the need has been there for a while. So in my view, this bill is about, is this the time to meet the needs of these rural communities, these populations that are entrepreneurial already, that are already here? We don't have to recruit them. We just have to give them a hand up.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Winkler-Rios. Certainly appreciate
thank you.
Your underscoring the importance of that issue.
I just want to thank you, each one of you, doing what you are doing. That will make our community, including all minorities, great, and we do appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so very, very much, each and every one of you, for taking time out of your busy schedules and for traveling long distances to present testimony here today. Certainly appreciated.
Thank you. Have a good day.
With that, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3027, and this committee is adjourned.
Thank you.